Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
But God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons. I'm Paul Perreault from Faith Radio, and in light of last weekend's racial protests and violence in Charlottesville, you might be wondering, is there a way forward in our nation that would bring healing? To that end, this and next week, we'd like to bring you segments of a Q podcast that was recorded shortly after the Ferguson riots.
The widest dividing worldview in America can be found not between liberal blacks and conservative evangelical whites. The widest divide was between black and white evangelicals. So the widest divide in the country, in the U.S., is in this room.
Wow.
I'm Gabe Lyons, and today we're going to have a conversation about race, reconciliation, and the gospel. And this conversation is not an easy one. I know for myself, this has been a journey that's taken many, many years. And then over the last few months, it's become much more intense to try to understand what's really going on in American life beyond what we see on the surface as it relates to race conversations. I have to admit, I haven't really given a lot of consideration to this race conversation. But as I've watched the news, it certainly started to raise a lot more questions. And I saw not just our news media raising this question, but I saw it amongst many of my friends, many of my African-American brothers and sisters who were wrestling with, what does this really mean? How are we perceived? Do we really actually have the worth that white skin brings to a conversation or into a certain climate or into society? I knew there had to be something more there for me to learn and hopefully for all of us to learn. And so the journey that we're going to take together today really began as an idea. The way I tend to approach these topics and issues is to try to create conversation. And so I knew one way we could do that is just bring a bunch of friends together, people who knew one another, people who had histories together, and then some who maybe had never met before, but who were thoughtful, who were people who could engage, who could go beneath the surface of just what we're seeing on the news headlines and actually try to understand what was taking place underneath. I mean, what was it that caused riots to take place in Ferguson? Was it just about this particular case and the details of this case or this grand jury? Or is there something more, something deeper that's been happening that's just now getting an opportunity to come forth? And so we're all recognizing it. And it begs the question, what is that? How can we better understand that? So as a Christian, it was important for me to try to get beneath just the surface. And so the way we did that was we hosted a conversation. I'm going to invite you in on that conversation today. You're going to sit at the table as we did for a whole conversation with 10 African-American Christian leaders and 10 white Christian leaders who came together to sit, to learn, and to try to understand. You know, we recognize that many times we don't understand because we don't take the time. We don't care enough. We don't have enough time in our busy schedules to sit and listen, to try to hear what the other person's saying. And so this was going to be an opportunity for us to sit in on that. We decided to host this conversation in Nashville, a city that had quite a connection to race and to misunderstanding and to conflict. You know, Tennessee's the place where the Ku Klux Klan was created and formed. In addition, Tennessee was a place where the governor was somebody who was very friendly to this conversation. The governor and his wife, Bill and Chrissy Haslam, Christians who've decided that they want to use their residence to have important conversation with a lot of gravity. And so they were gracious enough to let us use the Tennessee residence, as they call it. I wasn't surprised to know that John F. Kennedy had been a part of conversations in these rooms, that President Reagan and Clinton, even Billy Graham has visited this residence and been a part of important conversations with spiritual consequences as well as understanding policy. This was the right place to have this a conversation. Never been to the residence before until that morning, and of course the sun was rising. It was a beautiful morning, and driving into the neighborhood and past several mansions and large homes, it didn't escape me to look up at the governor's mansion and wonder for a moment, could this have been a place that actually was a plantation at some point in the past? You know, it ran through my mind, how are our African-American friends who are joining us for this conversation going to even feel about that? And so without knowing really the history, I just kind of went into this day and into the home, knowing that no matter what the past had been with this place, that the whole point of this conversation was to be some part of redeeming that, to be a part of moving forward, to move into the future where people who were even hosting us wanted to see this conversation happen. So as guests arrived, there was many hugs, many greetings, because plenty of these people are old friends, people who've known each other for a long time. And there were new people, people that we were meeting for the first time and were grateful that they had taken the chance and really made the risk to come sit in on a conversation that could get a bit contentious. And so we were grateful just for their willingness to travel and to join us and to be a part of this. Now, as a white man, I don't know what I don't know. And so this is a journey of my own to try to understand and discover what I've been missing in my own understanding. The thing I've learned is it starts by listening, not talking, just listening. And that's what this day is going to be about. We knew we needed to know who was in the room. What perspective were they coming from? What was the conversation that they were here to have? And so as we began that, I was blown away by some of what I began to hear. The first person I want to introduce you to is Carlos Whitaker. Carlos moved to the South from East LA, and so his background in history, especially around the topic of race, is quite interesting. He describes himself actually as a confused minority, and the reason he does is he talks about how his father's a first-generation black Panamanian immigrant. And because Carlos's father comes from Panama, he grew up hearing that he was Latino. But then when he moved to Atlanta early on, he started to see black culture and growing up realized that, man, if I want to associate well within this culture, I need to be black. And so he describes himself as confused. And now Carlos, as a quote-unquote confused minority, is now in the process of raising a very diverse family. Let's listen in as he describes the tensions of having a diverse family.
Speaking of confused minorities, my one daughter, Sohaila, whose skin is white as snow, came out whiter than her mother. She came out, she's 12. Her sister, same mom and dad, Sayana, came out darkest, beautiful, dark chocolate, right? They're blood sisters. And then we adopted our son, Losiah, from Korea. So when my wife goes to the grocery store, she literally says that the lady at the cash register looks at her like, you need to choose a man. But when Ferguson happened, I just remember sitting on the sofa with my with Sohaila and Sayana. Sohaila's 12 and Sayana's 10. And Sohaila again is my skin fair child, and Sayana's my darker child. And I remember Sohaila going, "Daddy, I don't understand." And 2 seconds later, Sayana saying, "I do." I guess a month and a half, I've been talking every day with Sayana, my 10-year-old, and oh my God, I just never knew.
Yeah.
Just her friendships and even her relationships that she's in. She's like, "Daddy, you know, none of my friends look like me." And they don't. So there's that, the parenting side of things for me, which, wow, these are homeschool kids. These aren't public school kids who are experiencing this. And so suddenly there was a separation between these two best friend sisters, 12 and 10, that I didn't know was there. So there's that.
Do you see what I mean? This conversation's quite complicated. And then there's Patricia Jenkins Armstrong, an original freedom rider. Now, if you don't know what a freedom rider is, I understand, because I didn't myself. It was just 18 months ago that I even first really heard about a freedom rider and the role that they would have played in the civil rights movement. Now, Patricia is sitting with us today as an elder, somebody who was 18 years old in 1961 when she took her stand for justice. You see, the Freedom Riders were civil rights activists, and they rode interstate buses into the segregated South. And so hear her describe what took place when she got off the bus in Montgomery, Alabama at 18 years old.
We got off the bus, and a rush of people came out of the bus station, and the bus station had a flat roof, and people were coming off the roof. And they had garden hoes, they had bricks, they had bats, everything you can think of that could be a weapon they had in their hands. I saw a lady with a baby, a young baby, attached to her in the cradle-like front thing. And she had a bat in her hand. So we started to run for our lives. There were no policemen around at all. Later we found out that the police had told them they had 15 minutes to do whatever they wanted to do.
It's still hard to hear these stories, to understand that real people went through this. This was America. This was just 50 years ago. And that there's consequences to that kind of action. There's consequences to people who've lived through that and generations who've gone before us and dealt with that. And so as we all sat somewhat stunned by the graphic nature of this story, stunned by the fact that Patricia, who was sitting here with us, had actually been through this. This wasn't just an idea. This was actually a part of her life, part of her story. I think we were humbled. I think we all knew that, man, this conversation matters. So the next person I'll introduce you to is Lisa Sharon Harper. Lisa's somebody who's been a friend of mine. She lives in Washington, D.C. Before that was in New York City. She's an activist. She's an advocate for justice. And it doesn't matter what the topic or the issue. She's one of the first people there on the front lines when something of injustice has gone forward within American life. You heard this when you first tuned into this episode, but I want us to hear it again in context. Lisa references the book by Michael Emerson called Divided by Faith.
The widest divide in worldview in America can be found not between liberal blacks and conservative evangelical whites. That's where I would have thought it was. He says in their 2,000 interviews that they did on the phone and 300 face-to-face interviews, they found the widest divide was between black and white evangelicals. Mm-hmm. So the widest divide in the country, in the U.S., is in this room.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know many people don't think of themselves as evangelicals, and even that term itself kind of brings up a bit of brand problem. And we go, well, that's not me. But you know, obviously, as you think about media and we think about the way generally Americans think about Christians and they start to break down Catholics and Protestants, well, certainly evangelicals represent the majority of the people that were sitting in this room. And the last person I want to introduce you to is Michael Weir. Michael is somebody who has a great history of understanding politics and public life, and he does because he's actually worked on President Obama's last two campaigns and then served for the entire first term in President Obama's White House staff. He mentions an important point that I think many in the room are feeling.
The opportunity I see now is, you know, again, kind of from the outside, but I've been, you know, I think the moment that we're unearthing some of this stuff, it also seems to me that the conversation has become more impenetrable for people who aren't in it and aren't living it. And so that is the concern I see. That is one of the concerns I see, which is that the very moment when you have a lot of white people not able to put their finger on it, but they know there's a problem there, there aren't the entry points that there used to be to entering into the conversation without people feeling like they have to learn a whole vernacular and five-step process of, you know, and if they miss one of the steps of acknowledging their privilege or kind of doing this, that they're stiff-armed at it. And, like, this is a time for opening doors to these conversations because we feel like we've been talking, feel like there have been conversations for decades about, oh, man, like, it's time to like talk about this stuff, and at just the point when people are like, "Wow, something's going on here," you know, the conversation's impenetrable. So I'm concerned about that. I think we have there's a moment here, but if the only way you enter the conversation is by reading the case for reparations, and that's like and taking up that language, like this is actually a time to be opening arms and like inviting people into this conversation. Sick as people are of it. As sick as people are of explaining things to people who don't understand and didn't care to until 2 minutes ago, it's also like
feel like that's part of like the job. Like if you don't want to have these conversations, then maybe it's time for like new leaders to come up who are willing to have those conversations. So that's why I see a lot. I see a more divisive conversation on race in some ways than we've had in a while. And some of that may be good. Some of that may be the churning of new kind of sentiments. But I think we need to start thinking about how we pivot to something that's more constructive.
I think Michael's right. Like we do have this moment, but it does take all of us sort of walking in with a fresh perspective to say, hey, I want to learn. I want to listen. And as you can see, we have a lot of perspectives in this room, and it's not just another headline for people. This is very personal. It's real and it's important. It's not just theory, but it's practical. And many people don't understand the events that recently happened in Ferguson. They see the rioting, but they don't get it. I mean, I'm hoping that today helps us get it a little bit more. And if I've been ignorant, I want to become aware of it. I don't want to sit in that blindness. We'll come back to the idea of rioting here in a minute, but I first want to talk about one of the most helpful, understandable ideas that came out of this conversation. The first time I heard the concept implicit racial bias came from my friend David Bailey. David lives in Richmond. He's part of a community there called Arabon that works with producing music and creating all kinds of beautiful opportunities within the neighborhood and community in which he lives that helps bridge many of these kinds of divides we're talking about today. But when he described implicit racial bias to me, it clicked. It made sense. It made sense that in my own life, I have some biases. I have things that I've never really thought much about, but that do weigh into how maybe I profile somebody or how I might consider whether somebody's dangerous just by the way that they look or because of my own fears and these built-in ways of seeing the world that actually affect how I might treat people. And so David explains to us what this concept means.
Implicit racial bias, we all have it. We all have it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a certain perceived kind of stereotypes, understandings, the way that we process the world. And when we see white, Kenyan, Korean, Black, you know, whatever the case may be, we just have certain kind of assumptions. Some of those assumptions are good, some of those assumptions are bad. But I think one of the things that implicit racial bias plays into these situations like a Ferguson or Eric Garner, you can hear it at work and at play. So, for example, gay probably has never, ever been referred to as a big, scary white man or an opposing white man. But a big, scary Black dude, you know, that just sounds normal to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's implicit racial bias at work, you know. I remember going to what we call the redneck part of town around Richmond, and I was going to this recording studio, and I saw this group of white guys. They seemed to be poor, and they seemed to be kind of redneckish. And I just got scared, to be honest. I mean, I just got scared. I kind of was like, man, still. But then the thought hit me. I was like, this is a push and racial bias happening right now. If they were like poor Black dudes in the Black part of town, I just wouldn't walk by them and wouldn't have been a thing. They didn't say anything to me. They probably weren't even thinking about me. But a push and racial bias was at work. Now I need to be able to, one, be aware of that within myself. And I also need to be in a Christian community where I can confess that and work through that or ask questions or, and I can say, hey, Chris, is that really a push and racial bias at work? Or is that kind of me being kind of smart and trying to be safe? Or, you know, I'm having a hard time discerning that. Can you help me figure that out? And then, you know, it needs to be safe. Or Chris says, man, Dave, you're a racist. You know, it's just going to, like, shut me down, you know. But I think we don't have language to deal with this. And we also don't have the expectation that we could do this type of confession within Christian community.
The concept of implicit racial bias. Now, hang with me. What we mean by that is pretty simple. It's not that it's explicit racism that's going on, that people are actively and with knowledge of them doing it are trying to be racist to others. I think many of our friends and most of us would say, no, that's not what we're doing. But this concept of implicit racial bias is a little bit deeper than that. It takes us behind what we would normally see on the surface to what's really going on underneath. And Greg Holder, who's with us, he's a pastor in the St. Louis area right near Ferguson. And he's somebody who, over the last few months, has been hosting conversations. He's brought people together, activists and leaders within that community, to try to find ways to do good activism, to do activism that's going to get the attention of the nation, but actually solve the problems within the local community. And so he's coming into this conversation very fresh, and he says this.
Maybe it isn't racial hostility, but in fact it is racial indifference. And that is exactly what is happening. That is the language that I'm using with people. So many of these folks that I talk to are not hostile to this. No matter where they land on it, they're indifferent. And we have to figure out how to speak in a way that brings people to the table.
And this is where it felt like the substance of this conversation was taking us all to a new place. There was an openness to acknowledge maybe where we have some of our own biases, but also an acknowledgement by David, as an African-American male, that he himself has biases. Even another participant in our conversation that day talked about whenever he gets on an airplane and sees someone of Arab descent, he actually profiles them. He thinks, if we're being honest, that many people do that, that we think about, was this person a terrorist or not, just because they might be wearing a head covering or something that we're not familiar with. And these are very practical ways that I think all of us, and especially as Christians, have to think about this sort of thing at a deeper level. Another concept that I know I've heard in my history as a white male is that part of the goal for Christians is that we should be colorblind. Being colorblind, where we just literally see everybody as the same and don't recognize that there's any kind of difference, that was the ultimate. That's what it meant to be a good Christian who didn't have any problems with racism. But it was interesting in this conversation today to hear a different perspective on that, to be told actually that that's not the best way to think about race. And so David continues to educate all of us about how we might think better about the subject of being colorblind.
It's key to understand kind of two concepts on race. There's a civil rights understanding of race and there's a post-civil rights understanding of race. And civil rights understanding of race is racism, meaning because of the color of your skin, there are certain things that you can or cannot do. And the presupposition of that is that white or lighter-skinned people are better than darker-skinned people. And obviously that goes against the image of God, biblical principles that, we all affirm. But in a age of colorblindness, and this happens in a sense where we say, like, hey, for white people feel like the best thing I can do is judge them by the content of their character versus the color of their skin. And that really comes from a good place. That comes a good motivation. But the challenge with colorblindness is that it does not have space for a different social narrative, and it doesn't have space for different cultures. And so we are the same in value, but we are definitely different in culture, and we're also definitely different in we're same also in other cultures. We see cultures both different and the same, and there's also different social narratives. Colorblindness really, I think that good intention but faulty practice really, really doesn't make room for us to share social narratives and different cultural expressions. And it kind of puts white people on defensive because it's like, man, I don't want to be accused of being racist by identifying difference.
I think David's onto something. He's talking about some very simple things that are pretty nuanced, but that if we just think a little bit better about it, it actually will help us become more aware of how we can be a part of the solution here and not contribute to continued problems where we don't value the other, no matter what that difference is. So this is one of the big ideas that came from today, but there are two more. As you can imagine, a lot of themes came up throughout this day, and we didn't have time to cover all of them, but there were a few that just stood out that were big, that felt fundamental. One of those ideas is this idea of the image of God. Now, this is a theological concept that some of you maybe have never thought much about. It comes out of the early writings in Genesis, where every human being is made in the image of God, that we're made to actually image God, that we give witness to who God is by who we are. But when you apply that understanding theologically to this conversation, it actually gives it some gravity. It helps us understand that the way we view the other, the person that's different than us, the person that's not us, that it's critical that we see them as being made in the image of God. Now, this is a uniquely Christian responsibility that we have. You might not ask every other citizen to consider it with this amount of weightiness, but for Christians, we must. And so Lisa Sharon Harper, who you heard from earlier, sets us off in this direction with a comment helping us understand the value and importance of the image of God idea.
The image of God is the thing that actually makes someone human, because everything else in creation is not given the image of God.
Right.
And by image of God, it means a representative of God. And then in the same breath, the word image is connected to the word rada, dominion. In other words, let us make them in the image of God and let them exercise dominion. And that word dominion, rada, in the Hebrew, in that context would have meant something like steward or agency, exercising agency to steward the land. And the number one and two things that will limit the capacity of human beings to exercise agency is poverty and oppression.
We have to stop the conversation here for this week, but join us next week as we continue hearing these voices who are searching together for answers for our nation. Gabe, you have some final thoughts.
Thank you for listening in on this conversation. I know you've heard a lot of voices, a lot of different perspectives. We've talked about some pretty serious concepts, things that really deserve more attention, more conversation. And so the way to do that is to get together with a friend, talk to your spouse, talk to the community of people that you live life with, and start talking about these conversations. Try to figure out, where have you been a part of the problem? How can you start to change so that you can create that change, so that you can be one of those one people that Patricia talks about that can be a part of the solution as we move forward? Because if we just consume information and we just listen to education, but we don't do anything to change the way we're living our own life, then it's all for naught. So I'd encourage you as you move forward today to think better about this and to be a part of advancing good in your community.
This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.